Perspective with Jesse Zurawell on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome to Perspective. I am Jesse Zurawell, your host for the hour. And I'm very pleased to say that my guest today is John Klizek. John is somebody I've wanted to speak with for quite some time, so I'm thrilled to have the opportunity this afternoon. John holds an MA in English. He has taught college rhetoric and research argumentation for over 8 years. His literary scholarship focuses on the history of global eugenics and Aldous Huxley's dystopic novel, Brave New World. John is the author of School World Order, The Technocratic Globalization of Corporatized Education, which is available from Trinday Books. And he has been a contributor to numerous media outlets, including Unlimited Hangout, the Center for Research on Globalization, Blacklisted News, Counter Markets, The Saker, and many more. John is also the director of writing and editing at Black Freighter Productions Books. And last but not least, he holds a black belt in classical taekwondo and is a certified kickboxing instructor under the International Muay Thai Boxing Association. So without further ado, John, welcome to Perspective. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Oh, I'm proud to be here, Jesse. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So you recently published an excellent piece at unlimitedhangout.com titled Barbara Marx Hubbard, Godmother of Transhumanism and Synthetic Spirituality, which takes a look at Barbara Hubbard, who was a Rockefeller-funded New Age guru, critical to the development of the ideas, beliefs, and technology necessary to market transhumanism as spiritual enlightenment. But beyond looking at Hubbard, you look at many other figures in the transhumanist movement, including some more contemporary ones who are doing active work as we speak to peddle transhumanism, I would say. And you also go into the vast litany of organizations and institutions that have arisen out of the transhumanism movement. And you point out, importantly, that transhumanism is essentially the next iteration of eugenics. But to lead us into our conversation, I'd like to ask you, how would you define transhumanism, and why should we be concerned about it? Why should we worry about it? Why should the average person, quote unquote, at least be wary of transhumanism?
Okay. Yeah. So as you know, transhumanism is the sort of the second iteration of eugenics. So the term is coined by Julian Huxley in a book called New Bottles for New Wine. I think it's about 1957 was when he published it. And basically what he says in there is that, you know, we can still do sort of old school eugenics in terms of like biological selection through, you know, the elites sort of inbreeding and then, you know, sort of calling the so-called unfit through, you know, mm-hmm. sterilization and euthanasia and stuff like that. But he basically says that actually the way that we really evolve at this point isn't so much through biological selection, but through technological selection. So basically what he says is that, you know, we'll have to add to the biological selection, the old school eugenics, we'll have to sort of merge human biology with machines. And, you know, at this point, that means the digital computer. Okay. And so the reason why I would say that, you know, there's a lot of, you know, I guess, positive uses that could be, you know, put forth. You know, I had a friend who had epilepsy and, you know, so they have some brain computer interfaces that can sort of control like epileptic seizures and things like that, help with people with paralysis and things like that. But ultimately, you know, we're moving towards a situation that's would move from transhumanism to posthumanism. And eventually they're, you know, will basically lose what it means to be human at a certain point. But at the same time, you know, you're talking about hooking up to technologies that are controlled by, you know, huge corporations that historically have not had our best interest in mind. And then you're also talking about basically hooking up these brain computer interfaces to, you know, the Internet of Things and the Internet of Bodies, having that link to like a social credit system, and basically having all of your bio algorithms sort of data mined and, you know, largely steered by a corporatocracy at a global level.
Yes, yes. And you make that point in many ways, several times throughout this piece. And I would add that a lot of people now are aware of the World Economic Forum and Klaus Schwab, but much of the discourse around the forum and Schwab has to do with its secrecy or the Potemkin village it sets up each year in Davos, or the private police that it seems to have. And not so much of the discourse focuses on what seems to me to be the end game, at least of the Schwabian contingent of globalism, which is the fourth industrial revolution, which is, if not wholly dependent, in very large part dependent on transhumanism and posthumanism. That gets missed, I think, in a lot of the dialogue. And when you bring it up, even in alternative media spaces, you sort of get looked at askance often, as if this is something that is, as if transhumanism, posthumanism, the fourth industrial revolution are some fringe concepts, rather than the very real end game of the globalist predator class, as I call them, or the globalist parasite class, as Ian Davis has referred to them. This is the end game that they're striving for, and not just striving for, but making very manifest moves as we speak toward this end game. Would you agree with that assessment, that that's something that often gets overlooked when we talk about particularly Klaus Schwab and the World Economic Forum? A lot of it tends to focus on, as I said, the cultish nature of this individual and these entities, and the real end game and the danger it poses to humanity is missed.
Yeah, you know, for some time now, I mean, it's, I guess it's gotten a little more traction, but, you know, there was for the longest time, you know, if you even said the word Great Reset, you know, people would just say conspiracy theory, right? And, you know, I mean, we're talking alt media circles here, but, you know, I mean, in academia, you know, I teach college, and, you know, transhumanism isn't even a topic of discussion, you know, I mean, let alone, you know, what's going on at Davos on a given year. But yeah, you know, that's definitely the operating system. I mean, you know, Schwab himself, there's that infamous quote, you know, where he basically says we're going to fuse our biological, our physical, and our digital identities. And it's something that's been in the works for a very long time. I also wrote a piece called From UNESCO Study 11 to UNESCO 2050. It's on Unlimited Hangout. And basically, I looked at something called Project BEST. It's better basic education skills through technology. It was a it was an educational technology program that was leaked by Charlotte Thompson Iserbeet, who wrote the foreword to my book. Was my dear friend. She passed away earlier this year. But you know, she was working for the Department of Ed, and she leaked this document, and she gave me all of her files before she passed. And so that's what's given me the lead for the whole series I did on the unions. But it started with looking at Project BEST. And what she saw in there was basically, you know, laying the groundwork for the fourth industrial revolution. They didn't use that term necessarily, but they did keep talking about this information revolution that was just around the corner. And so Project BEST was basically laying the groundwork for, you know, sort of the infrastructure that we're seeing to, you know, sort of build the next level of, you know, the brain computer interfaces, the metaverse, the Internet of Things, the Internet of Bodies, which ultimately is transhumanism. I mean, on a spectrum, it starts with ubiquitous screen time. Then we move to wearables, mm-hmm. or instead of carrying your device in your hand all the time, you just have a, you know, smartwatch or a, you know, an EEG monitor or a heart monitor, like a heart math monitor that I talked about in the last article, the Hubbard article. And then eventually you just, instead of wearing it, you just plug it in either to a, you know, like a Musk type neural link, or, you know, you can eventually Kurzweil, people like Ray Kurzweil, they pontificate that we'll have nanobots through the bloodstream. So it's definitely, you know, the end game, and it's been that way for quite a while.
Yes, I would agree with that. So given that it's been that way for quite a while, I think it's safe to say that Barbara Marx Hubbard is someone who throughout her life for many decades shepherded the transhumanism, posthumanism movement along to where it is right now, which is rapidly developing and rapidly changing through the work of people like Mikey Siegel, who comes out of MIT and is now working at Stanford, if I'm not mistaken, which brings up another point that a lot of this might sound fringe to a lot of people, but the people and entities who are pursuing transhumanism and posthumanism are deeply embedded in very influential institutions like MIT, like Stanford. So while it may not be on a lot of people's radars, it's deep within, you know, the military, industrial, technocratic apparatus of the state. And that's something we need to keep in mind. Because that gives it its reach, its influence. But who is Barbara Marx Hubbard, and why, in your view, is she so, is she essential to understanding the push toward transhumanism and posthumanism?
Okay, yeah. So Hubbard, she's the heir to the Lewis Marx Toys fortune. She was heavily connected with the Democratic Party. She ran for vice president under Walter Mondale. Her dad was friends with Dwight Eisenhower, and she met with him once upon a time. And so she was independently wealthy and politically connected, you know, from the get-go. And then throughout her life, she would become inspired by a Jesuit priest who also promoted eugenics in his writings. His name was Pierre Teilhard de Chardin. And then she would also be mentored by very important people who have basically shaped the history and also the future of psychology and biology and actually virology. And so two of these people would be Abraham Maslow and then Jonas Salk. And through Abraham Maslow, she basically promoted his human potential movement. And in my article, I quote from Maslow's Toward a Psychology of Being. And in there, he talks about how he developed humanistic psychology as this third force of psychology that branches out from the first two forces being behavioral psychology and psychoanalytic psychology. And this third force, he said, would lead to a fourth force of psychology that would, he said, would be called the transpersonal. But he literally uses the term transhuman. And to sort of promote this transhuman psychology, he formed something called the Eupsychian Network, which Hubbard was also a part of. And it was through the Eupsychian Network that he said was all people that he again coined the term that they were all transhuman in perspective. And a lot of these people were out of Esalen. And Esalen is where you mentioned Mikey Siegel. Mikey Siegel did a presentation on hacking consciousness. And the way he does this hacking consciousness, you know, the Esalen Institute is sort of this new agey kind of retreat where you do, like, you know, trying to reach your human potential, or what Maslow called peak states or self-actualization through, you know, all sorts of, you know, maybe mindfulness, meditation, maybe psychedelics. And now, you know, using technology to sort of leverage these retreats, and sort of using Siegel would have, he has something called Heart Sync, and he's got some other feedback, biofeedback wearables, but this Heart Sync thing, technology, basically you use this to monitor your heart rate and do some mindfulness breathing meditations and sort of get into some sort of a transcendent state that helps you reach your human potential. So to bring it back to Hubbard, right, she was basically this new age guru. And so she sort of puts a spiritual spin or a spiritual layer on top of the all the technocratic stuff as far as transhumanism is concerned. So if we talk transhumanism, we're thinking, right, the evolution of technology coming out of this sort of Darwinian, you know, Galtonian eugenic perspective, which is very materialist in its outlook. She sort of ties that into something she calls conscious evolution, which is the evolution of what Teilhard de Chardin called the noosphere. And the noosphere is sort of this energetic or metaphysical intelligence of the cosmos or the universe. And so she sort of blends the biogenetic and technological evolution with this intellectual or consciousness evolution, and sort of gives it sort of a spiritual twist that I guess makes it a little more palatable than just, you know, all these big tech corporations wanting to hook you up to machines, right? It's going to make you feel like it's good for you because you're going to finally reach this mystical state with the help of technology, which, you know, we should just note here that, you know, even, you know, the transhumanists like Kurzweil, who are, you know, we might think of as technocrats, you know, they frequently use these, you know, religious metaphors referring to godhood, right? That these technologies will make us godlike in some way.
Right. And with Hubbard, she and her mentors and her contemporaries often use the term Christification, which I found quite interesting. This borrowing of New Testament Christianity and fusing it with this New Age spirituality. But we need to throw it to a quick break. However, when we come back, I want to get into what you sort of warn us about in your most recent piece, which I should say is part of a series, an ongoing series that you'll be publishing. And you warn us about, and you've sort of touched on this in this segment, but you warn us how this is meant to lull us into complacency with regard to essentially being willing slaves of the fourth industrial revolution. So I'd like to get into that point when we come back from the break. So more with John Klesik after this.
We wear the PPE and wade through the muck so you don't have to. Never miss our thought-provoking take on the latest news and current affairs. Take TNT Radio wherever you go. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio, or download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk. This is TNT Radio.
You better lock up your sons when the X-Girls hit town. We're an irresistible force. We have the power to get whatever and whoever we want. Let's go. Time to find somewhere hot. We cut through the traffic. No one can stand in our way. Wait there. Don't move a muscle, the paramedic said. Well, the driver said I just ran out in front of him. I can't remember anything, but I've been told I'll be on crutches for a while, and my miniskirt-wearing days are over.
Too much alcohol makes you feel invincible when you're most vulnerable. At least 77% of pedestrians killed in road accidents at night had been drinking. Alcohol. Know your limits.
How about some good news? There is a cure for hepatitis C. A simple blood test will tell you whether or not you have hepatitis C. More than 9 out of 10 people who receive highly effective treatment are cured, and less likely to develop liver cancer or liver complications. One little blood test, and you'll have done your part to help eliminate hepatitis C for good. Get tested. Get treated. get cured. Visit hep.org for more information.
Government today.
They're not human. They ought to be destroyed.
It's like all the children from the Village of the Damned grew up and went into politics.
You can't stop us, you know.
Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to Perspective. I am Jesse Zerwell, and I've been speaking with John Klesik. John is a professor of rhetoric and research argumentation, and his literary scholarship has focused on the history of global eugenics and Aldous Huxley's dystopic novel, Brave New World. He is also the author of School World Order, The Technocratic Globalization of Corporatized Education. And we've been talking about the latest iteration of eugenics, which is transhumanism moving into posthumanism. And we've been using John's recent excellent piece published at Unlimited Hangout, piece which is part of an ongoing series titled Barbara Marx Hubbard, Godmother of Transhumanism and Synthetic Spirituality. And before the break, we got into a little bit of who Hubbard was, who her influences and contemporaries were, and how she gave a patina of spiritual enlightenment to a progressing transhumanist, posthumanist movement. Should also add that she was heavily funded by Lawrence Rockefeller of the infamous Rockefeller dynasty, which has been long been proselytizing and evangelizing eugenics, transhumanism, and posthumanism, I think it's fair to say. But John, one of the things that you, or essentially the essence of what you're trying to impart in this piece is that even though these technologies and these ideas are peddled, I would say, as being beneficial to our spiritual enlightenment, to pursuing a sort of one world communitarianism, that's really a red herring of sorts, and these technologies are meant to lull us into complacency, to go along as good worker bees, essentially, with the fourth industrial revolution. Am I correct in saying that?
Yeah, as evidence, I focused in particular on something called the HeartMath Institute, which was promoted by Hubbard in several books. And so one of them is Birth 2012 and Beyond, and the other one is the title is something to the effect of Conscious Evolution, Awakening Our Social Potential. And in both of these, she promotes this HeartMath Institute, which actually has two, there's a nonprofit branch, which is the HeartMath Institute, and then there's a for-profit branch, which is HeartMath Incorporated. And what it does is, so it's basically a company that uses multi-level marketing, and you know, this ties back into the whole human potential movement, because in the way that multi-level marketing and the human potential movement come together is that, right, in multi-level marketing, you get people to sort of sell these products for the company, right? And so at HeartMath, right, you can be like a HeartMath coach, and then therefore you get certified to teach other people how to use the HeartMath wearables, which are these biofeedback wearables that I sort of talked about earlier. I talked about HeartSync, Siegel's HeartSync, but they're basically the exact same thing for the same purposes. And so you have these coaches sort of promote the product, but then by promoting the product, right, the coaches themselves and then also the people receiving them, we're all reaching a higher level of consciousness or some higher human potential. So you yourself ostensibly become... Ostensibly, correct, right, right. And you become a product, right, along with the product you're selling, right? And right, so the goal here at HeartMath is that not just will you be able to sort of manage your stress and stuff like that, and, you know, maybe achieve some sort of mystical, you know, meditative state, but they also have programs for companies, and then they also have programs for schools, right? And so you can use this on a collective level, right? And so Siegel and one of his partners talked about the possibilities, and I'm going to paraphrase this, but there's a direct quote, which is pretty close, which is that, you know, you get everybody at the board meeting on these wearables on this, and you get them to synchronize their heart rates and their biorhythms prior to trying to make some sort of board decisions. Right. And so everybody is sort of like on the same wavelength. And I guess that, you know, should help with streamlining whatever decisions need to come probably from from the top down. Right. So it's basically a way of leveraging something that was known as the Delphi technique. So you go to a board.
And if I can just add there, he also talks about how that's meant to get the participants to dispense with their egos as well, which you could read into, I think, safely and say, you know, dispense with their individual identities, which in the end is a big part of what transhumanism and posthumanism is all about. So I found that quite interesting, that part of what you were just describing.
Yeah, 100%, right? So, you know, so you come to the board meeting with an individual perspective on maybe, you know, how a policy that's being proposed is maybe, you know, not going to work, problematic, maybe it's not ethical, right? Maybe, you know, you're going to get the short end of it as an employee, right? And you want to voice your opinion as to why, you know, maybe we shouldn't actually, you know, vote yes on this. And you know, this wearable is sort of gonna, you know, put you in some sort of a psychological state where you're less likely to create friction with the groupthink, right? And that's at a corporate level. You know, they've got the use for these wearables. One of them's called M-Wave, and the other one is called Inner Balance. And I actually I cited M-Wave in my book because I found that it came into use in schools as I was writing my book. So a similar use there, but maybe for like test anxiety. But then you can extrapolate it out from sort of the institutional or the corporate level to a global scale through this thing they have called HeartMath's Global Coherence Initiative. Mm-hmm. And so everybody gets these wearables and there's an app that goes on your phone, and then you can pull up like a social media platform that's going to have a globe, and it's going to have little like points of light that sort of graph where other people are also synchronizing their heart rate at that moment in time. And they'll have these calls to particular meditations. And so everybody in the globe at a particular time is supposed to put their wearable on and meditate on a particular issue. And so this part is not in the article, but I had some people that used HeartMath and were like, you know, I think you're sort of conflating things. I don't think it's really used for make people complacent and things like that. So I dug a little deeper, and I found, in fact, that, you know, they have had meditations where early last year, I want to say halfway through the year, when some of the lockdown stuff started to slow down, they were... The meditation said something like this, and you can find this on my Telegram page. It said that, well, you know, we're happy that we're probably starting to unlock, but don't get too impatient, because you need to be responsible for the other people around you, and we can't just quite go back to normal yet. And the meditation itself is called Patience for the New Normal. So they wanted everybody to put the wearables on and meditate on, you know, sort of channeling positive energies to have more patience, to not just go out and, you know, act like the old normal again. They wanted you to sort of comply with lockdown and social distancing for a little bit longer at least. And so they literally were using that HeartMath Global Coherence app to get people to meditate on obeying the lockdown orders.
Right. And I think to your point there, a lot of this technology is quite advanced, but a lot of it at the same time is still in very early days. And the point is that it's progressing rapidly. It's developing rapidly. It's evolving rapidly. And while it may not yet be at the point that those who are pushing it want it to be at. It's getting there, and you can see signs of it, like the one that you just pointed out. And I found it quite amazing that there is actually an app for this sort of heart coherence, social synergy idea that you can get on the Apple App Store. I found that quite amazing, and you have a graphic in your piece that shows what it looks like. And on the surface, it seems like, yeah, well, okay, maybe this is how it's working, and maybe things are synchronizing. Apparently, it especially through the work of people like Mikey Siegel, this has been empirically shown to be at least doable. If it's not happening, I mean, he piloted one of his products at Burning Man. So you talk about embedding this into popular culture. I don't think you can get much better of an example of that than Burning Man. And then, you know, that also brings up where this movement we're talking about now has its roots, which was in the counterculture 60s and the psychedelic movement. And psychedelics are still a big part of this movement. I know I've met a lot of people when I used to live in New York who worked for Google, who were very much into the micro dosing of psychedelics, and it's all still there and still developing. So when people say, well, I think you're jumping the gun here or seeing something that's not there, I think it's important to remember that, you know, just like with CBDCs, for example, the infrastructure isn't quite there, but it's getting there. And those pursuing it have no intention of turning back. That's the danger that we need to remember.
Yeah. And, you know, there was a lot of people that were sort of identifying from, you know, either the old hippie counterculture or maybe like Gnostic traditions that were like, well, we don't use it that way, or we don't see the overlap between either, you know, mysticism and transhumanism or psychedelics and transhumanism, you know, and, you know, maybe on an individualized basis, it might not be for, you know, a certain person in the way that they approach it, but historically it has, right? And you can just look at one of the quotes in the article from Humanity Plus or H Plus magazine, which is the publication arm of what was known as the World Transhumanist Association. And there's several pieces in there that you can find where they overlap, you know, the idea of the human potential movement, psychedelics as a technology, and then sort of Gnostic mysticism, all as sort of precursors to transhumanism. And if you just look at people like, you know, we'll just talk about who was the Leary. We got a book on the shelf. Timothy Leary, right? I mean, he was the guy who obviously popularized the LSD movement. But this was a guy that also, you know, sort of, you know, predicted that you know, technology and VR and things like that, and the Grateful Dead made similar statements that, you know, VR would sort of be like the best psychedelic trip. And, you know, Leary was also friendly with, you know, Crowley. Okay. And Crowley obviously, you know, is, you know, the Crowleyan magic, which has its, you know, Gnostic origins. And so, you know, there's a point at which, you know, whether you're trying to get to a mystical state through like transcendent meditation or channeling, or whether you're trying to use a psychedelic, or whether you're trying to use a technology to sort of get to this state, to achieve this, you know, higher human potential, you know, the transhumanists would say something like, what's the difference between you doing deep breathing meditation on your own, or using like a candle or maybe a meditation bell, or why can't it have some electronics involved in it? Why can't it be a wearable or some sort of, you could put a headset on and you can focus on different, light signatures or whatever. To them, right, if a psychedelic is a technology, sort of using the, if you remember Space Odyssey 2001, mm-hmm. The monkey in the beginning, what's the first piece of technology? It's a bone that he uses as a club. And he throws it right. in the sky, and the symbol is that it becomes a space station. So to them, it's a sort of a slippery slope argument, but it's all the same thing to the transhumanists.
Right. And one has to wonder if that's out of convenience for them or out of perhaps a failure of imagination or laziness, or if they actually believe that. I'm sure there are some who actually believe that. But I really find it interesting that's one of the ways that the counterculture of the 60s sort of co-opted, in a sense, into this, they call it transhumanism, post-humanism, but to me, it's anti-human in the end. This is about doing away with human individuality and the uniqueness among us, among how we think, how we act, what our pursuits, our individual pursuits and desires are. That to get that on a global scale is the ultimate dream, I think, of the globalists who are pursuing this transhumanism, post-humanism enterprise. Of course, what comes along with that is population reduction, eugenics, which, was something that the Nazis first brought to the fore, at least in practice. So we have to throw it to one more quick break. But when we get back, I want to ask you about how eugenics or population reduction factors into this, and also talk a bit more about the Hart Math Institute, because it seems to be one of the entities that's really at the forefront contemporarily with regard to pushing transhumanism and posthumanism. So quick break and more with John Klezek after this.
The midterms and America votes on November 8th. With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Jeremy Beck.
Vice Chair of the Virginia State Bar and Professor of Law Henry L. Chambers Jr. has just released an article titled Supreme Court Allows States to Use Unlawfully Gerrymandered Congressional Maps in the 2022 Midterm Elections. Published in The Conversation on the 2nd of June, this article referred to the Supreme Court's Merrill v. Milligan February ruling against the lower federal court in Alabama. At the time, the Guardian newspaper charged that the Supreme Court is helping consolidate white political power in America. Blacks who voted for Republican candidates will likely disagree, and divisive arguments about gerrymandering along racial lines could help stoke further violent protests, as happened following the enormous legacy media coverage of George Floyd's killing. I think it is clear that certain powerful establishment interests find racial divisions useful to divide and conquer. I'm Jeremy Beck for TNT Radio.
Through the training.
Through the drills.
Through the driving rain.
Through borders. Through bushes.
Through barbed wire.
Through doors. Through windows. Through walls.
Through water.
Through mud.
Through dirt.
Through pubs.
Through clubs.
Through thick and thin. Through the noise.
Through the shouting.
Through the silence.
Through it as a unit.
Through it as a team.
Through it all together.
Your local infantry regiment is recruiting. To find out more, visit your local Army careers office or go to armyjobs.mod.uk. One Army, regular and territorial.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
Solar power is supposed to help the environment. Modern economies require power 24/7, not just when the sun shines. And storing power is very expensive. Peak electricity demand in many nations with service-based economies occurs late in the day as the sun is setting. And cloud cover means we can never depend on solar power. Photovoltaic solar panel production is very resource-intensive. Coal is the primary energy source used for photovoltaic panel production. And China, the world's biggest coal producer and consumer, produces two-thirds of the world's solar panels. While solar panels have a limited life of around 2 decades, some fail well before then. But nearly all solar panels currently go to landfill, as the cost of recycling is so high.
Government has taken our rights and will never give them back unless we make them. The voice of freedom is TNT Radio.
Welcome back to Perspective. I am Jesse Zerwell, your host for the rest of the hour, and I've been speaking with Professor John Klesek. You can find John on Twitter at Taoist Professor, I believe your handle is. Professor Taoist, sorry, and that's T-A-O-I-S-T. And he's on a number of other social media platforms, including Telegram, YouTube, BitChute. But if you go to his website, schoolworldorder.info, and you go to, I think it's on the main page as well as every other page. You can see at the top, there's Follow Me, and it's a list of all the platforms where you can follow John and his work. You can also find many of his excellent articles, including the one that we've been speaking about at unlimitedhangout.com. And this article is, I believe, the first in a series that you're working on, John?
Yes, correct.
Okay. And I should say that we are really only scratching the surface here of what you lay out in this piece. I mean, it's an amazing history that you've compiled here, and it's so labyrinthine. I mean, the number of people and entities throughout the 20th and 21st century that have pushed this, it's amazing, and the ties to the Rockefellers, the ties to, I was shocked to see Abraham Maslow involved in this, because I've always known of Maslow's, sort of hierarchy and self-actualization being at the top of that. I was taught about this in a very basic way in a psychology class I took in college. But until I read your piece, I had no idea that he was really a fundamental figure in the early transhumanism, posthumanism movement. So that said, I recommend everybody head to unlimitedhangout.com and read this piece. It's fascinating, and I think really at the forefront of how we should be thinking about globalism and resisting it, especially with regard to the fourth industrial revolution, which is a very real concept that is trying to be made fully manifest by not just Klaus Schwab, but a lot of people within the Davos clique and outside of it, but affiliated with it. So that said, John, I wanted to ask you how eugenics, which essentially comes down to population reduction, if you're talking about weeding out the so-called undesirable or unfit, how does that factor into right now the push that we're seeing, the iteration of the push that we're seeing for transhumanism and posthumanism right now?
Okay, so we might start by noting there's a quote from Hubbard where she basically promotes culling a large portion of the population. I want to say it's like a quarter or something like that. Now, I'm planning to work that into the next piece, where I'm going to focus on sort of her Malthusian eugenic bent and how it sort of stems from Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, and then how it sort of is getting pushed into what's now known as sort of the sustainable development agenda, mm-hmm. which, she also promoted that. And she did cavort at the UN. She gave speeches there. We might also note here that the roots of this go back to the Limits to Growth document from the Club of Rome, right? And this is right. Sort of, so, sort of to bring it full circle, And I need to find that original quote. It's on her Wikipedia, and it supposedly is in the Book of Co-Creation, but you know, I don't run with stuff unless I can verify it. But basically what it demonstrates is that, you know, if you look at the sources of limits to growth, and I've got a copy of it on my database, so you can check it out. I think it's been PDF elsewhere online. But if you just look at the citations in there, right, a lot of them are people like Population Council, Population Reference Bureau. There was a document in there that was promoted by Rockefeller again, right? So the idea of the sustainable development, we usually think about it in terms of like climate change, okay? But it's always been intimately tied with this idea of overpopulation, right? Malthusian ideas about, you know, limited resources, and, you know, only so much of the pie to go around. The pie doesn't get any bigger. So it's not just about managing your carbon footprint, and it's not just about managing, you know, resource consumption, production, and things like that. It's literally about managing how many useless eaters are out there to, you know, make a carbon footprint to begin with. Okay. And which brings us back to Hubbard's quote that basically, you know, it's something to the effect of not just do we need to get rid of a certain number of people to have a stable planet, but also, you know, that it'll be good because, you know, some people just won't be willing to evolve. And so, you know, it's sort of a humane thing to sort of get them out of the picture. So, you know, Malthusianism and eugenics is basically one is about quantity, the other one's about quality. So, you know, Malthus is like, you know, what's the optimum population size? And we should note that Julian Huxley, who is also the, you know, I mentioned he coined the term transhumanism, but he was also the director general of UNESCO. In that document, he promotes global eugenics, and he also promotes an optimum population size. He was also one of the founders of the World Wildlife Fund, which has also promoted this idea of, you know, Malthusian overpopulation. So, you know, insofar as we need to manage from Malthus' perspective and Huxley's perspective, you need to manage an optimum population size, right? What kinds of people do you want to have, right? Or what ratios and proportions do you want of sort of the elite managers and then all the other, you know, button pushers and lever pullers on the bottom? So that's sort of your, you know, how Malthusianism ties into the current, you know, paradigm about this new sustainable movement, and sort of the eugenics part is like, what type of people do we want to make? And so we can tie that into this transhumanist idea that, well, you know, we can sort of engineer that through wearables, other devices, and maybe we can otherwise sort of condition people with social credit algorithms.
Yes, yes. It's very, there are a lot of corridors leading into each other with regard to this, but, you know, they all do intersect at some point. And I think there's an argument to be made that what we've been seeing with the rollout of the injections that were peddled as vaccines for COVID-19 is a form of this, because we're talking about a genetically modified serum that's now been proven to be clinically worthless and proven to be extremely harmful, if not lethal. But along with the rollout of that, the injections from various entities, we saw in tandem a campaign of sorts, and it's still happening, to push people, to coerce people into taking this injection, not once, not twice now, but to four or five times. I think Israel is up to its fifth injection at this point. And I say injection very intentionally, because these are not vaccines. These are injections, and I would say lethal injections. And the fact that they are genetically modified, it's not messenger RNA. That's not what the M stands for. It stands for modified RNA. The fact that this genetically modified serum is being injected into people and doing who knows what besides all of the damage that we've been made aware of so far, I think there's an argument to be made that this is a push toward transhumanism, posthumanism, and certainly eugenics and culling and weeding out certain people, identifying certain people, those who refuse to go along with the program. So I think that's a real time example, but I don't know if you'd agree with that. I'd like to get your thoughts on that.
Well, yeah. So there's an overlap between the injections and something that's called precision medicine. All right. So the precision medicine initiative was set up by Obama. And basically what precision medicine is it's sort of this new iteration in allopathic medicine where everything is going to be quote unquote personalized. And that means based on your genes. So basically some form of a gene therapy. I know people would like to split hairs and say that, you know, an RNA therapy is not a gene therapy because it doesn't actually mess with your DNA. Although, you know, DNA and RNA are sort of a, you know, a reading and computing system that go together, right? I mean, so if you're sort of dealing with one, I mean, I think it's, you know, it's sort of to me splitting hairs, right? I mean, ultimately you're messing with the mechanism at which, you know, either your DNA or your RNA expresses something phenotypically. So this
yes.
is basically,
and just to add to that real quick, to the best of my knowledge, it's been shown in vitro that these mRNA injections can reverse transcribe DNA. So you really are messing with somebody's genetic makeup with these injections.
Right, right. So, you know, I mean, the DNA is expressed through the RNA, right? So it's just, you know, you're just going one layer above it, but ultimately, right, you're playing with the same thing, right? Interesting note here, you know, Lawrence Rockefeller, who funded Hubbard, you know, he funded her, helped her set up her foundation for conscious evolution, but he also came up with one of the first venture capital firms, and it was called, I think it was called Rockefeller Brothers, Inc. originally, now it's called Venrock. Well, once upon a time, I don't know if they still fund this company, but there's a company called Cirna Therapeutics, S-I-R-N-A Therapeutics, and they specialized in, quote, RNA interference technology, all right? So, you know, we're right back to, you know, the Rockefellers being involved, and he was, you know, funding a bunch of other stuff like Genetics Institute, another company called Targeted Genetics, 10X Genomics, Unity Biotechnology, Element Biosciences, Regenex Bio, all sorts of biotech stuff, and apparently also RNA technology. So again, this goes back to precision medicine, which is, you know, part of, again, to go back to what Huxley said, yes, we can do eugenics in terms of, you know, tinkering with biology, you know, at the sort of the biochemical level. But we could also merge it with technology and sort of, you know, rather than just do the crude, like, you know, let's sterilize somebody or euthanize them. Well, now we can genetically engineer the actual DNA or RNA at the fundamental biochemical level. And I should also note, though, that part of the precision medicine initiative was a study called All of Us. And there's a guy, his name was Eric Dishman. I don't know if he's still a part of it or where it's at this point. I wrote this article a long time ago. I think it was on Natural News. You can get it on my website. And basically, Dishman, to figure out or to correlate particular pathologies with a person's biochemistry and their genes, not only would they wanted to get, I think, at least 1 million people into this study and then take their genetic signature, but then give them wearables and then get these wearables to monitor their other, you know, the EEGs, heart rates, galvanic skin response, other sort of biorhythms, and then throughout the day correlate that with, you know, what do they eat, what are their habits, you know, sleeping lifestyles, work habits, and then sort of try to find a way to, like, figure out what are the epigenetic correlations to their genome so that you could be more precise with these precision gene therapies, right? So again, even with the precision medicine initiative, right, you had this movement to sort of use wearables to help refine how we want to, you know, genetically engineer or how we want to therapeutically treat gene-based issues.
Yes. Yes. And I think that we have to wrap, unfortunately. I could speak to you for many more hours, and I hope you'll be willing to come back and continue this conversation, because I think there's a lot more that we can get into. And as I said, it's rapidly developing. But wearables, implantables, as Whitney Webb, your colleague, has pointed out, these are what we really need to be wary of, afraid of, and reject, because they're an essential component of pushing all of this forward, and data mining, and then synchronizing that data and using that data against us. And there's a lot to be said there with regard to why Lord Elon Musk is making a bid for Twitter, what his intentions are. But I think we'll have to save that for another conversation if possible. So John Klesek, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. We just scratched the surface, but I think it's important to get this information out there, because this is coming at us fast. So thank you again, sir.
Thank you, and be happy to come back anytime.
Great. That's it for me for this week. Stay tuned for the Misty Winston Show next, and I will be back at the same time on Monday.